Hi there, Billy Hindle here, the voice of Alice Dyer in the Magnus Protocol. As part of the Magnus Archive's 10th anniversary, Rusty Quill is hosting a special Magnus Live show at the upcoming Crossed Wires Podcast Festival in Sheffield. Join co-creators Jonathan Sims and Alexander J. Newell on the 5th of July for a new iteration of our live show, Statement Begins, where you can hear fan-favourite statements such as Anglerfish, Red Live, and gain exclusive insights into the creation and history of the show straight from the creators themselves. You can buy your tickets now, including limited numbers of meet and greet tickets, from crossedwires.live or the link in the description of this episode.
Hi everyone, it's Kareem, the voice of Simon Fairchild from the Magnus Archives. Today I'm here to advertise Beck's End, an upcoming new audio drama that will be launching on the RQ network. Beck's End is a folk horror audio drama about isolation, belief, radicalization, and poses the question if redemption is possible. When floodwaters swallow an idyllic English Lake District village, a stranded journalist finds herself trapped in a rising tide of fear. Cut off from the outside world, she begins to uncover horrors both human and biblical, lurking beneath the surface. If this intrigues you, you can support the creation of Beck's End on Kickstarter until the 17th of July. For more information on the show and to pledge your support, visit becksend.com. That's becksend.com. And you might recognize a voice here or there. Have fun and enjoy the episode.
Hi everyone, Alex here. I'd just like to take a moment to thank some of our patrons. Spooky, Kate Talbot, Lisa Kay, Jari Thorup Parlow, Lou Harrison, Elliot, Claudia Howard, Amanda Lord, Sarah Cavanna, Jessica Freeman, Fresh Cat, Dog, Elizabeth Kalbacher, Ayn Morgan, Corvin J. Lynn, Kit, Cody Wolf, Iris Lazuli, Spa, Carrie Leclerc. Thank you all. We really appreciate your support. If you'd like to join them, go to www.patreon.com/rustyquill and take a look at our rewards.
Hello again!
Welcome to Magnus Archives Season 4 Q&A Session 2.
Part 2.
Part 2, because we have a lot of
questions.
Two question,
two furious.
Yep. From our perspective, we stopped
Step up
for...
Step up to the questions.
We have stopped for 5 minutes before immediately pressing on with a new round of questions. So, with that in mind then, I'm going to...
Q&A leak... 2, question boogaloo. Q&A 2, the quickening.
I'm going to jump into the first question.
Q&A 2, Q&A harder. This one's at an airport, but it's basically the same thing.
Miri asks, was Ben aware before the last few episodes of Season 4 that Elias was possessed by Jonah Magnus? If not, when did you guys tell him and what was his reaction?
Oh, when did he find
ben
out?
Ben knew it... well in it, like ben, more than yeah. a season.
It's really weird because what different voice actors do and don't know is often kind of determined by them.
It's non-standardized.
Because generally we'll lay out all of their story to them pretty much from the off. But also we're really bad at not just massively talking spoilers when we're in the production space. So some voice actors will, Faye specifically, is very keen to not be spoiled.
Which does not gel with how I direct, which is lovely.
Because they are very... into actually listening along. Lyd used to really not like spoilers.
She gave up the ghost
but
at
then,
some point.
Then gave up the struggle at some point and just like, yeah, okay, just tell me what happens.
So some people argue that you give a better portrayal if you don't know what's going to be coming next.
Sure.
I argue the opposite and that I think it leads to better script reading if you do know the destination because you can focus on like the foreshadowing and making the bits that matter land more and so on. It is up for debate. It is like there are different schools of directing. But generally speaking, I err on the side of telling people pretty much their arc as far as is reasonable. So I wouldn't like in episode one tell someone how they're going to end in season 5.
Yeah, we told Ben right from the off that Elias was one of the big bads.
Yep.
We didn't go into a lot of detail with him at the time, both because Jonah Magnus as a thing hadn't been fully fleshed out for us.
Yeah.
And also because he hadn't even been mentioned in the series at that point, so there wouldn't have been any context for Ben to understand anyway.
And it would have been irrelevant to his characterization.
I think we laid out everything about Elias to him early season 3, shortly before the big villainous turn.
Yeah, Ben knew he was the big bad. straight out of the gate. He didn't know the name.
Well, he knew he was a bad.
So he knew he was a big bad. He didn't think he was an arbitrary bad.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, end of season two, beginning of season three, we're like, here's the nature of your badness. Mm. But I don't have a specific date or anything.
No. And generally, Ben has been one of the ones who I've always enjoyed his reactions to discovering the twists quite a lot. With different voice actors, some of them are like, oh, cool. Some of them are like, oh, okay. Ben is very much a sort of like an appreciative, like, oh.
Ah, but only in a... So Ben's very expressive, and I feel safe in saying, with Ben, what makes me laugh is Ben doesn't hide if he doesn't approve of a story move as well.
Yeah.
So if you give him a story move and he doesn't think it makes sense, it'll immediately be a, right, okay. What? Until he gets the remaining character things that are relevant. It has happened for Magnus once where he's I can't remember what it was. I think it was something like, why is he killing Lightner? He's like, cool thing. I don't understand why this is happening.
No, because we gave him the script before we'd laid out.
So he basically turned up going, it's a cool story move. I don't understand why this is happening. And he doesn't do that. Ooh, he goes, cool, there's a problem that needs solving.
Yeah.
But then the second that he's given the context, it goes, okay, cool, great. But he's a very expressive man.
That sounds like that might have been the time we actually laid everything out.
I feel like that might actually have been it. So that's even earlier than we think. Okay, in that case then, I am going to carry on with a little bit, which is a similar one from CMP, which is, how much backstory do the general cast know in advance?
We kind of covered this a little bit in the last question. The answer is, it's very much up to them. Most of them, I think, know a random smattering of significant upcoming twists. And though not from season five, actually.
That's what I was going to say. We're now in a really weird situation where, for most people, us saying this is what's going to happen has generally resulted in, and then the world ends.
Yeah.
So we're actually in a weird situation
very few
where
of them
performers
asked,
now...
What happens after the world ends?
So now we're in a situation where I'd actually say performers know the least about their arcs than they have for years, because everyone was always satisfied with, and then the world ends.
Yeah.
I think Ben was the only one who, of course, goes, but then what? You know?
Yeah, Ben knows a little bit of what's coming.
He does.
But yeah, it's always weird having people, also people within the wider Rusty Quill family, who sort of come into Magnus, because they'll have osmosed stuff from a production point of view. Like when we brought Helen as the therapist, which, oh, incidentally, that's... I'm really sad about Helen as the therapist. Just because everyone decided that she sounded really spooky and thus was really plot relevant. And I was like, oh no, we forgot to cast someone because it was such a small bit.
We ran out. We ran out of people to cast. Like, everyone who was on our casting books was either unavailable, out of the country, or already cast in other roles by that point.
And then Helen was there for a gaming recording, and like, we'd kind of penciled her in for some stuff in season five, but we were like, okay, well, it's fine, it's a very small role, it's just like three lines, no one's gonna really notice, like, we can reuse you in season five. But now everyone decided that the therapist was massively significant and massively
It's because we introduced a speaking character in season four.
It was just meant to be a playful swipe at the Black Tapes and Tannis and the Bright Sessions, all the ones where it's like, okay, so now we're going to get a lot of story through these tape recordings of a therapy session. I thought it'd be really funny to have can I record these therapy sessions for exposition? No, you can't. No exposition. I thought that'd be a really funny little joke.
Didn't
just
come
a playful
off
little
hope, did it?
No, everyone has been hanging theories on it, and I'm like, oh, that's not ideal.
Is it too late to make the therapist Jonah's therapist? Okay, how did you go about scripting and editing the sounds of the apocalypse in the season finale?
Well, from a scripting side, I think, something along the lines of the world goes horribly wrong, everything is bad forever.
I think that's the stage direction, or as close as it gets.
Yeah.
In terms of audio, I am going to reveal something I didn't think I was going to reveal, but I'm feeling honest today.
Feeling fruity.
I don't like my soundscape for that episode at the end.
Oh.
I don't feel like I did it justice properly. If I had another stab at it, I think I could do a better job. However, that is in a way where I know in my heart of hearts that the only person that would tell the difference between the one I would make and that one is me. In terms of how it was made, Bizarrely, I actually used loads of leftovers from The Lonely.
Really?
I did loads of soundscape experimentation with The Lonely and ended up with a few that were completely inappropriate for The Lonely, but quite useful. However, the soundscape for The Apocalypse is actually a bit too dense. There's more layers than the human ear is really going to be able to pick up on. So there are things like pitch shifted
like
and slowed down screams. There are some winds from an actual desert in there.
Like a too tall cake.
There's a really peculiar distortion that I managed to stumble on where basically it is the sound of a magnetic tape breaking.
Like a weird cake.
But yeah, again, it sounds strange. I'd probably strip a bit out and make it a bit clearer what's going on if I had my way. Too much detail on that one, I think.
Disagree.
Story questions.
All right, let's hit it.
This one's from Bells. Good question. I like this one. Will we get any more information about the original Elias Bouchard?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Like, his major contribution to the story is having his eyes nicked.
It is true.
But that doesn't mean we won't find out a bit more about him.
I think more context is probably going to come through at some point. I don't think it is something upon which the entire story will pivot.
No, it's not.
Elias-centric masterpiece.
Yeah, the pre-Jonah Elias is not super plot significant, but that doesn't mean he won't get a little bit more exploration if we have time.
I like to think as well, honestly, he's just not that interesting a guy.
No,
that's kind of the point of him.
Like, he's in my mind, he's kind of a lightly posh dickhead who just kind of coasted through uni and landed just a weird little academic job, and crucially didn't have a lot of connections who would miss him if something were to happen to his eye colour. Or shape. Or presence.
Right, on to a writing question specifically.
Grand.
This one's from Dez. I find that writing and working on intensive, dark material can often be mentally/emotionally taxing. How do you, especially in long takes, sessions or scenes, take care of yourself?
This is actually something I'm not great at. I find that the emotional aspect doesn't get to me as much because I tend not to write things that I personally find too emotionally draining. Sometimes it will end up in that territory, especially with like The Lonely.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I write the sort of horror that, though it might give me that sort of ooh, scare, as I'm writing it, it's not going to... The emotion I'm getting from it is a sort of... kind of slightly sadistic glee, I guess. So I don't find the writing of that super draining. What I'm bad at is I'm very much a deadline cruncher, which is something I've been gradually getting better at over the course of Magnus. Certainly early on, my challenge was not shotgunning the writing of two episodes like the day before a recording and absolutely destroying my sleep pattern. Within recordings itself, a lot of it's just drink a lot of water, take regular breaks. Don't scream so much that all the oxygen leaves the room and you all start to feel dizzy.
Yeah, that's the thing. You get used to that. You acclimatise. You really do. From my perspective, I'm quite lucky in that I've said before sometimes I'm a bit weird when it comes to the writing side. No matter what I've written or no matter what I've worked on, it just doesn't occupy the same part of me as actual real-world emotion. For me, scripts, even when I'm writing the most emotional thing ever, are still almost a puzzle to be solved. So it doesn't have that effect on me. I would say in terms of other cast, this season has definitely been the one that has prompted the most emotional responses from performers. Again, 90% of it due to The Lonely, if I'm honest. And there has been ones where part of being a director is learning to read the room, and part of that is being like, cool, I don't know, we are behind schedule for an hour. We still now need to take a 15-minute break because if we don't, you're going to break someone or you're going to end up just completely ruining a recording day because no one's in a state to record and things like
also,
that.
Also, there's if somebody sort of comes into the recording in a bad way because of stuff outside of the
happens.
Show, you've got to make sure to just give them the space they need and fundamentally work around it because their well-being is always going to be 100% more important than whatever your own artistic vision might be.
The self-care thing is really important, It's extremely important on the artistic side because we have been exposed to a lot of false narratives that sacrifice of self is a necessity for artistic endeavor. And I don't believe that is the case. I think that, yeah, you have to put time into the thing that you make, but it has mutated over the years into the ideas that you have to, you have to punish yourself in order to make something of worth, and it's not true.
Also, I think the overwhelming narrative is built up that your productivity is your value is something that, we both struggle with, I think. And the worst thing is that it doesn't actually make you more productive. It just makes you feel worse when you're not doing stuff.
Really, really high in a way that they don't need to be.
Yeah, it just means that if you're not doing work, you feel really bad. It doesn't actually mean you're doing more work. And it's something that I think we both still struggle with, but it's a very important thing to learn.
Creativity is not a stick to hit yourself with.
Yeah.
It's that simple. And productivity has become the new way of disguising the old idea.
It's the whole thing of like, ugh, on my seventh cup of coffee and I haven't slept because I've been... Right, it's like, that's glorify, bad. Don't do that. It's not a good thing.
People are right.
Which is something we're still...
I actively struggle, but I will
learning.
Never, ever do the thing of like... Yeah, it's when people brag about, I'm getting by on like 4 hours sleep. It's like, what are you doing?
Why?
Stop.
Sleep is good.
If nothing else, it's inefficient.
Here we go.
You've got to maintain the engine. And that's real. That's real evil here, is the inefficiency of it as a system.
I would say it is about your own well-being. And what's this? We're finally dropping caricatures and laying bare
That was the truth, Alex's core. It genuinely really bugs me. It bugs me because you're making life harder for yourself in the long run. Trading off your long term for your short term doesn't work. It goes wrong. You end up running a podcast company. Okay, that one was a joke. I should bring this
mostly.
I'm going to bring this back.
Yeah, let's wrangle it. Just drag it
resembling
back
an actual episode here. Okay, I'm going to loop back around then.
Sure.
Oh, interesting. Okay, this one's from Orchid. Alex, what was it like to voice Martin while he was in The Forsaken? Staying with the high truth, which I'm trying to do for this Q&A, actually really annoying because. It just so happens at the time we were in a real quagmire of production issues. It was when the stuff was going wrong with Alistair's audio and the technical stuff and blah, blah, blah. It's really, really difficult when a day of production is going down the toilet to then go, and now I'm sad and kind of distant. Because what
drifting
you want to do is go,
away.
So
problematically calm.
Yeah, I would love to give a real deep, like, exposed my core of my being about what it was like. Honestly, 90% of it was just trying to take how a day is going, a bad day, putting it in a box, putting it on the shelf, and getting the audio. It took more takes than it should have.
Oh God, I'm sorry. I'm just remembering when we were recording the cabin scenes, and you'd just hurt your foot.
I had really, really a lot of foot pain due to like minor surgery
and it was
stuff.
Giving you this weird manic energy, and
I
was like, no, it's domestic. It's chill, it's relaxed, it's a respite before all the horror. And I was like, yeah. Of course I'll let you know if I see any good cows.
Good cows, yeah! It was not good. We had to do a complete retake. It was not good. Here's something useful. In terms of points of reference in order to play Martin in that situation, due to varying situations, I have spent chunks of time around people who are on things like heavy neural inhibitors, things like that. Often it's just like a pain medication, things like that. So of all the things, I weirdly use that as a bit of a touchstone. But in terms of, again, whether it emotionally upset me or anything, I'm really sorry. Mostly I was angry when I was recording those lines. That might not be as glamorous and
to be fair, like
my
heart-rending like shouts for Martin were mainly just us doing it again and again, trying to get the exact levels right so that they weren't clipping, but were also clearly shouted.
And Johnny was being really good with me because I was getting real antsy that day. Okay, we're going to abandon that for a little bit so I can just forget the memories.
Sure.
Just forget that feeling and not get that manic energy back. We're going to go on to talking a bit more about story again.
Yep.
Specifically from Constantin Valdor.
Mm-hmm.
Given the actions Eric and Melanie took to leave the archives, what extreme actions would one need to take to sever their connection to other entities?
Oh.
So you're talking how would you throw a roadblock against the desolation, or how would you do the same against the end, things like that? I don't feel like there is an option for the end unless you are making...
No, I mean...
All actions with that would get you further in because it's showing an obsession that the end kind of is
Yeah, into. The end's actually a really interesting one because it works very strongly in both directions. I mean, the thing to do with the end is essentially what Georgie ends up accidentally doing, which is just no longer fearing it.
Just check out.
Just like, and in Georgie's case, it wasn't something that she, or rather, I feel that like after a certain point, she did choose it, but
it's a bit mucky.
It's a sort of a grey area
in terms of other ones, though.
Yeah, that's a real good question because it's not about the physical action; it's about the categorical and very concrete rejection,
also via dream logic as well.
Yeah, like via sort of fairy tale dream logic.
I don't think this is the one we're going to have to be able to answer on this, for the simple reason that it's actually going to require quite a lot of thought.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I'll be honest, it took quite a while to nail down for the beholding, because like while it's technically a very simple act, a very simple answer, it took quite a journey to actually arrive at that. As there were sort of various drafts, and it was only when we like came up with that we were like, yes,
that'll work.
That's the one.
I'm trying to think. I don't even have another one for any.
I mean,
something
like the desolation. If you were to legitimately sacrifice your life for someone you loved,
I suppose. But at the same time, does it count as being severed from an entity if you're annihilated attempt?
Well, if it would be if you survived.
Oh, you'd sure. Okay.
Like, I don't think
a pure altruism sacrifice.
Yeah, like
style.
Like it would need to. Like, I think for the desolation, like a pure act of altruistic love. But at the same time, that's not quite as concrete as you need to blind yourself,
because what we'd need to do
need
is
to destroy your eyes.
What we would do is we'd have to take that as an idea and then find a symbolic physical action to manifest that emotional swap.
Mm.
And I don't know what that would be. That's a really good question. Where I have
the
to
stranger,
get a lot of thought.
The stranger, you gotta run through the town centre nude, just bare it all, no disguises.
And if anyone draws attention, you have to engage them in a conversation. You don't just fly.
Yeah,
by.
No, absolutely. You walk through and you engage people. You're very, very honest about what you're doing.
Absolutely. There you go. That'd work. That took a weird turn at the end.
Oh, the flesh, you go veggie.
That's not... No, I knew you'd say that. That's not correct. You know
it's
what?
Not, I know.
In fact,
know.
That's going to jump me back to... This is going to jump me back to a question on cast, because
right,
you've brought
me
to
sure.
it, right? This is from Hannah.
Sure.
Is Johnny a vegetarian? Honestly, after all the meat content, I might just become one myself.
No. My relationship with meat is, as you might have guessed, complicated. Basically, I'm not a vegetarian. I wasn't a vegetarian. At the beginning, it was much more a fear about body horror and gore. And then in episode 30, I did a bunch of research into abattoirs and was like, the industrialized meat industry is real bad. And it's been something of a low-key struggle since, because I really like meat. And at this point, I don't eat a lot of it, especially because a lot of other people in my life are vegetarian or vegan. So, like, most of the meals that I cook at home, or that we eat at home, are vegetarian. But I will still generally, I might get a steak if we're going out to eat, or a burger or that sort of thing. So, I feel that
you are definitely
meat
light as a person.
Yeah, I try to be a conscientious meat eater, even though that's kind of a contradiction in terms.
But you do have a coherent sort of set of rules in terms of what counts as people and not.
Oh yeah, also I have occasionally seen people being like, oh, this guy's got to be a vegetarian because he keeps saying that there's no difference between human meat and animal meat, and I'm like, oh no, the other way around, in that I don't think, like, let's be clear, probably wouldn't eat, I mean, I wouldn't just eat a person.
I mean,
okay, I wouldn't eat a person.
There are contexts where I would.
I mean, no, there are contexts. Like, this is the point. Like, I feel that, I mean, obviously, prion disease aside, like, I wouldn't actually, because prion disease is horrible.
Oh, God.
Yeah. but I don't fundamentally see a difference between eating other meats and eating human meats.
You need a short, pithy, like three-word phrase that encapsulates
don't kill
that.
People.
And also, meat is meat.
But like, also, if someone was dying and was like, "Hey, after I die, cut me up and eat me," I probably would.
So diving in then, just because I know this specific thing about you. Corvids, people or not people?
Oh, corvids are people.
Octopus, people or not people?
I have a list of animals in my head that I consider people. Let's see, octopuses, corvids, dolphins.
Apes.
If I believe an animal is capable of choosing to... Oh, elephants. Elephants are 100% people.
Yep.
If I believe that an animal is capable of choosing to do evil... then it's a person.
You've never mentioned that to me before.
Well, but no, because there are elephant serial killers.
True.
Corvids will pass down their vengeance list to their children.
Oh, but now you're getting into the nature of evil.
This is why I say it's a very personal thing.
Okay.
Because I don't really have a solid, like, this is what evil is. But at the same time, I can be like, okay, so these dolphins helped Dick Van Dyke when he floated out to sea. These dolphins murder baby seals for fun. Those are clearly actions that are not being taken based on instinct, because different dolphins are engaging with the exact same thing in different ways, some of which are cruel and some of which are altruistic. It's a very weird, very personal thing, but honestly, I think if an animal is capable of doing something and I'm like, you know what, that was a dick move and you could have not done that, I think it's a person.
I love that your criteria for what constitutes, like, a person is, are they capable of badness?
Yeah.
What a bleak vision of the world.
It's not, are they capable of badness? It's, would I judge them for being bad? Like, if a dog does something bad, I'm like, oh, that's a real shame. The owner's messed up. That dog was following what it's been taught, was following its instincts. I don't blame the dog.
But an octopus that climbs out its tank.
An octopus that climbs out, sneaking around, and stealing. Every night unscrews the lid to its tank, climbs out, oozes itself across the aquarium floor into other fish tanks, eats the fish, oozes back out, back into its own tank, and then screws the lid back on. That's a bad octopus.
So what we're saying, Hannah, is thank you for a question that I knew would immediately open a can of worms in the best way possible.
I'm so problematic now. Johnny Sims, definite cannibal.
we're going to move on.
I've never eaten a human.
We've got to move on. Unconfirmed. Okay, so this is a production question from Forney. When you record as Martin and the Archivist, how often are you recording together in the same place versus recording separately and combining the dialogue in post?
We're always together.
There has been one time where we haven't, and it is because a single line needed a pickup from
me. Okay, so let's be clear. All my dialogue is recorded with Alex in the room. Sometimes there have been Martin lines that he's recorded in isolation to drop in, but all my lines are recorded in the presence of Alex.
Follow-on question. From Playfully Evil, has Johnny actually been in the same room as Alistair Stewart yet, or have they never managed it?
Once. We had, to be fair, I've met Alistair in other scenarios, but we were recording together for the final, the big confrontation between Peter and the Archivist.
Yeah. This ROM is from Theatre_Ghost98.
Sure.
I want to know about the other 97. Melanie had protection from being a part of the Archivist's nightmare zoo, for lack of a better term, because she worked for the Institute.
Right.
Did she lose that after she quit, or is she exempt because she can't see anymore?
Oh, I don't think we actually addressed this directly.
It hasn't been addressed in the series.
I would probably say, like, if it's not in the text, it's not canon. My headcanon would probably be that severing her connection with the eye probably means that she doesn't
participate in the Nightmare Zoo,
but also it would only have been for a short time anyway, because the rules
have changed
significantly.
So we'll do one from an alert. Is Jan Kilbride still alive in the buried, given John said it didn't help that Gertrude killed him before chucking him in?
Kinda.
I think that's all you can really say on it.
Yeah, chucking someone into one of the entities is probably a bad idea, regardless of whether they're alive or dead.
Correct.
I haven't really worked out the details of Jan Kilbride's situation and how much it is still a situation, but it's probably not great.
from Demon Cleric were Agape and the Monster Pig animals that became avatars?
Ooh. What a good question. Huh. I'd mainly been conceiving of them as monsters in the sense of direct expressions of the entities.
But pigs are people that can make choices, Johnny.
No, pigs are. I don't think pigs are quite people. They're on the cusp. They're on the cusp. I personally don't quite think they're people, but I respect those who would disagree.
Okay.
But yeah, you could 100% see them as avatars. Although, actually, not in the case of Monster Pig, because Monster Pig emerged, like, turned up from nowhere.
Yes.
If there was a particularly horrid pig.
But Monster Pig explicitly, there is an extra pig in there and it wasn't there.
Yeah. Agape, maybe? Like, as I've said, I don't personally conceive of dogs as people enough to necessarily believe that any choice they would make would be concrete enough to constitute a pledge. Yeah. But it's a really interesting thought, and I am very confident that there are going to be a lot of fanfics out there that explore it far better than I would.
On to another writing one.
Grand.
This one's from Elisis. Johnny, can you talk about how the Magnus Archives comments on capitalism and getting tangled in systems of oppression?
Not really, because it's all in the Magnus Archives. Like, I'm broadly speaking, I think capitalism's a big and that systems of oppression are real bad, but it's all very complicated because it's impossible to extricate yourself from the system. And if you do extricate yourself from the system, how much that is actually helping to dismantle the system is difficult. But also, when you're within a system, working to dismantle it is really difficult as well, because the system is designed in order to take your efforts to dismantle it and channel them into reinforcing different aspects of it. And it's all a big, wobbly, complicated, unpleasant mess. And, you know, you could theoretically say that's analogous to the fears. A bit.
There's an additional factor here as well, which is worth bearing in mind, which is just because of the nature of, like, people who are engaged in the arts and so on, as a group, we do tend to lean left. So that will affect the things that we make as a direct result of that. But I wouldn't say that it is written entirely as a treatise and manifesto.
No, but, like, it's very much, yeah, as I've said before, it's very much our examination of a lot of these thoughts and topics. And yeah, capitalism is definitely one of the most cohesive metaphorical frameworks, but I think there are quite a lot of other metaphors that you can use it for. It's about being caught in systems bigger than yourself, which I think is what cosmic horror speaks to
very well. I think it's useful because it's a useful real world large scale system that people get swallowed by.
You could also look at it as analogous to finding yourself working under a totalitarian or fascist regime.
Yeah, true.
Like the idea of, like, well, no, you have to participate in an actively harmful system or you will yourself receive harm.
Yeah.
What is the moral thing to do in that situation? Yeah, it's difficult questions and no easy didactic answers, at least not from me.
Well, then let's jump onto one that I think you can have an easy answer to.
Sure.
From Nimbus. It's been nagging me since I started producing fan work back in season one.
Mm-hmm.
Does the Institute have a dress code?
Yes. It's on, like, maybe page 8 of the Institute policies, and people read it, and then they look around and see that most people kind of disregard it.
It's unnecessarily arcane in how it's written.
Yeah, like, it doesn't give any examples. But
the word appropriate is used like 14 times with no reference to how something can be appropriate.
It's very much there so that if Elias needs to call someone up on something, he can just be like, and your dress is unacceptable.
Oh, you know what it is? It's the Magnus Archives equivalent of loitering. That's what it is. It's loitering. It's a rule that only comes into effect if I need to punish you for
Also, no one in the Archives has ever been pulled up on it, and it's a bit of a sore point around the rest of the Institute that
The disheveled mess of the archives
staff always look just
horrendous.
Absolutely horrendous, and no one ever says boo. Whereas, like,
David, in research, he wore jeans that were slightly shorter than intended.
That doesn't sound appropriate to me.
It wasn't appropriate. Apparently, it wasn't appropriate. He wore them with sandals, is the thing.
Well, that's why it's inappropriate.
Like, he'd worn them before with, like, proper shoes, and no one had said anything. But weirdly, when he put them with sandals, it was the jeans that Elias was talking about.
Sandals are a trip hazard.
Well, but he didn't mention the sandals.
Oh.
He was talking about the jeans. So awkward. where's the line?
Okay, cool. From Luna Quill. Had you always planned to release the final episode of Season 4 on Halloween, or was it just a lucky coincidence? I can answer this one really easily. Originally, we were hoping not to need to have a mid-season hiatus, so Halloween wasn't on the cards. Once a mid-season hiatus was on the cards, we sat down, ran the numbers and went, well, ending the world on Halloween,
actually,
that'd be just
You know what would
swell.
Happen if we had this length?
That'd just be swell. So it does mean as well, rather foolishly, that the mid-season hiatus was a little bit shorter than it should have been.
Also, there was a real danger because it was almost on Brexit Day. Mm. And I'll be honest, I was absolutely terrified that our episode about ending the world would be forever associated with Brexit Day.
But this does lead on to a pretty heavy question, actually, which I think a lot of people will want to know for various reasons. From Lunatic Poet, for both of you, have you experienced creative burnout while working on this podcast? If so, how do you normally recover from that sort of burnout?
Yeah. Some of season two, some of season three. To a certain degree, I had to push through the burnout, which was real bad news. Generally, it's not something that you can force a recovery from. You've just got to kind of be kind to yourself, actively ensure that you have the downtime, don't beat yourself up for taking the time to recover, and just wait for it to get a bit better. It was lucky that I don't think it overlapped with any of the massively significant episodes. So it was very much, I withdrew from a lot of stuff that wasn't Magnus or day job. Aside from those two things, I was mainly just kind of locked down in recovery mode.
Creative burnout hasn't been too much of an issue for me, for the simple reason that one of the sad truths about running the business side of things is that, frankly, I don't get as much creative output as I would like. A lot of what I'm doing at the moment is working with other people's ideas, which is an enjoyable thing in and of its own right, but I haven't done the sit down and write for like 2 days solid in a long time. I haven't done it.
To be fair, thinking about it, my burnout was less creative and more writing in terms of the actual process of writing. Like, I could still conceive of episodes.
Yeah.
It was...
You've never just been dry.
No.
I've never known you to be.
Which is good, but also like worrying because it'll happen someday and I'm a little bit dreading when it happens. But no, it was the burnout was much more in the sense of it was just a really, really physically uncomfortable and difficult thing to sit down and type out the words.
Yeah. I'd love to give people advice on how to deal with burnout. I don't really have a solution. Mine comes out in slightly weird ways. So what I have learned over the years, which is a unhelpful thing to learn, is that I delay when it happens till like when it can be dealt with.
Oh, you do the teacher thing.
Yes.
You do the teacher thing where you get through the term and then suddenly you get massively ill
every single time. And you can always tell how I'm doing because my weight fluctuates. I don't have a solution for this. But what I would like people to take away from this as a Q&A, so I'll explicitly state it, is there is a danger when you are in a position of even minor responsibility within an industry or within a system where you can end up setting a bar or setting a precedent.
Yeah.
Magnus is the release schedule it is due to things that were beyond my control at the outset. And if there's one thing I want people to take away, it is not the belief that the only way to get this scale of growth is by basically sacrificing yourself to do it.
Yeah.
It isn't that at all. And the last thing I want is people to use us as a bar where if you're not putting yourself through the grind.
Yeah, we're not doing this great. I mean, the only thing that I'm quite proud of how we do this is that we don't push the other people involved.
No.
Like, we're very conscientious of their well-being.
Well, that was heavy.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Let's move on to a nice, easy one.
Yes.
Story. Boom. Eyeless Jade. Will we see a bit more of Melanie and Georgie during season 5?
Yes.
No, they're gone forever.
No, they'll be there.
All characters that you know are now gone forever.
We haven't fully laid out season five. We'll talk.
They'll be turning up. Don't worry, you're fine. If nothing else, we'd be running out of characters that people know if we hammer many more. We're now going to jump on to a story one, mm-hmm. which has been asked by Look Alive Sunshine, but I know has been kind of kicking around the fandom a bit. Are Daisy and Basira in a romantic relationship?
Oh, okay. This is going to be quite a long answer, so I'd ask that people bear with me. There is never going to be an explicit textual clarification of that, for a very specific reason. So with each relationship within the series, there is a specific thing that I'm trying to explore, a specific mm-hmm. dynamic that I feel is the core of the relationship and something that I am really interested in exploring. With Daisy and Basira, what that has always been is the idea of partners within a, in this case, the police, but within a context of an us and them mentality. So the idea of having your back against a world that is believed, rightly or wrongly, to be hostile to you.
Yes.
The sort of compromises that get made and the sort of excuses that you create for yourself to allow certain very harmful, occasionally even evil behaviours, because you have this mentality of it's us against the monsters.
Well, you end
we
up
have
in moral paradoxes.
Exactly. We have to have each other's backs. And so it is this, and especially how it manifests within the context of something like police work.
Yeah.
Now, adding an explicitly romantic aspect to that relationship would, to my mind, massively complicate and potentially
subvert
it, making a sacrifice to excuse the violent and harmful acts that someone has done because you are in love with them is a very different thing to making compromises to excuse the violent and harmful acts someone has done because you have their back within a police or a context of us versus them. That's not to say explicitly that they are not. I'm 100% not saying they are not romantically involved, and I'm not going to go into what my own headcanon is, because that would have undue influence.
It'd have massive ramifications that are going to detract from the point you're trying to make.
But I will say that textually, that's not a relationship that's ever going to be codified one way or the other. Basira's entire arc is explicitly intended as an examination of how a siege mentality within somebody who conceives of themselves as, to one degree or another, keeping the peace or defending people can turn toxic.
Yeah. This one's from Jane the Brain. Johnny, have you ever worried you'll run out of statement ideas?
Yes.
Hasn't happened yet.
No, not yet. I actively try and collect them from people around me. If anyone ever says anything particularly spooky or anything that locks into my brain as potentially having a spooky aspect to it, I will stop the conversation and I will note it down.
I am still wanting us to do one on coffin syndrome in submarines.
Yes, I know.
It's great.
Well, I don't know if we'll be able to fit it in season 5.
I genuinely don't know if we will.
But we'll see.
Okay, I am well aware of time as it's ticking by, and we have ended up giving some heavy answers which have eaten some. So I am going to make sure that we
hurtling
get through...
Hurtling towards the grey.
I'm going to make sure we try and get through a few more that people are wanting to get answers to, and we probably should do in the public.
Sure.
So, Hail the Wanderer asks, mm-hmm. You've mentioned previously that in order to assume their full powers as an avatar, a death seems to be required. Does it make a difference that the death used to fuel the archivist's transformation was that of another avatar?
I don't feel that a death is necessarily required to become an avatar. What is required to become an avatar is always active choice.
Yes.
You need to make an active decision to finally cross that threshold.
Because drama.
And death is a very good motivator for that sort of decision. You know, the prospect of death is very scary, and it's such a powerful, categorical thing that in many cases it is going to be the catalyst.
But what I might say is I'm going to ask the next question because I think they bleed together.
Sure.
From Kara Roth, why does the corruption revolve so heavily around love and looking for love? Because I would use the corruption as one of the examples of
where
ones...
They tend not to die
or no, necessarily involve a death, because that's a devotion. It's the whole Eros, Thanatos, love and death
Freud.
Thing. But what that comes back...
What a co-caddle.
But what that comes back round to, though, is that I would argue with the corruption, more than most of them, has probably less active death in it, and it's more obsession and love.
Yeah, the corruption, it does engage a lot with the idea of love and toxicity within that.
Yeah.
And the things you do, not just for, like, romantic love, but for a sense of belonging.
Yeah.
It links thematically, in my mind, to the idea of the hive, to the idea of colonies of mould, almost. A lot of insinuation. The idea of, like, the many as one and being part of a group or part of a whole, and how that very deep human desire can be corrupted and can turn rotten. Although, I suppose, in many ways, that does link back to death in the idea of, like, the death of the self.
True.
The idea of subsuming yourself in a wider whole, which...
In terms, then, of the original question to do with avatars and whether a death is required for transformation...
It is not required, but it is common.
Yeah. I think that's probably the simplest way of putting it.
Yeah, you know what? I'd go so far as to say that a metaphorical death... is required.
I can tell you now that a metaphorical death will be required for the simple reason that if it isn't happening, it's kind of a bad bit of drama.
But that's where
script versus law.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, the thematic aspects are beholden to the drama of the thing.
Yeah,
like, the fact it is a fictionalized thing where you need to have some pretty high moments of drama mean that your more domestic avatars that, like, just will come to their full power through just, like, being horrible in very mundane, real ways, they're probably not making the cut for the drama. It's mainly the death.
Mainly the death.
Death on sex.
Right, we're going to jump on to complete tonal change.
Yes.
Boom, from basically everyone. How's the Admiral doing?
Oh, he's... you'll see. He's fine. He's happy.
What really... Here's a sneaky little pet peeve of mine that really bugged me. Everyone was going on and on about, oh, we want the Admiral back, we want the Admiral back. I put the Admiral back in, but it was the one where Melanie's there going, I'm sorry. I can't help you now. No one cared, apparently. There was too much going on. So everyone had been fighting tooth and nail to get the Admiral. He's there. He's having a great time.
Yeah.
No one bats an eyelid.
The Admiral's having a great time.
40-foot tall, with laser beams for claws.
We'll see.
Okay, we are now perilously close to running out of time, so I'm going to do a quick fire across the board and just see how many we can get out.
Cool.
Okay, you ready? From basically everyone. Johnny, how did you get through the closing chant of 160 on a single breath?
I was a choir boy from the age of 8. Like, I can do breath.
From Mealy Bit?
Sorry, I mean Eldritch Strength channeling my Dark Masters.
Of course. Oh, actually, you know what? I'm going to add one thing. This should be quickfire. He did that like 4 takes on the trot, never batting an eyelid, and we had to take no precautions or extra steps whatsoever. It was quite peculiar.
I can do an invocation.
It was just funny. He did 4 on the trot. You were like, cool, do you need another one? And then didn't breathe between one and the next. It was a bit
yes,
weird.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
It was
did.
A bit weird.
Yes,
bit
I did.
Weird. Right, from Mealy Bit. Johnny, how did you go about doing your best Ben as Elias impression? Did Ben record a version for you, or was that just your skillful ear
it's
VA
actually,
skills?
It was actually incredibly simple, because Ben once confided in me that his Elias voice had originally just been based on my archivist voice, just making it a bit more smug.
Yep.
So I just made my archivist voice a bit more smug, and it worked.
So it's the exact reverse of what you think.
Yeah, I reverse engineered it because it was remarkably easy.
From Vine Tabris. Johnny, the laugh John does at the end of 160 was the perfect mixture of terror and delight. How many times did you have to practice to perfect that laugh?
We didn't practice, but we did a lot of takes.
I believe that was one of the days where production was running into issues, so I was a little bit more like, do it again, do it
again.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. No, we did about, like, I think 10 takes of the laugh. But, like, this is the thing about working in audio. You tend not to practice as much as you just do a lot of takes.
Record
because,
the practices.
Yeah, because
it could be perfect.
Any practice could be the best take.
So, this is from FFS.
Mm-hmm.
Will we find out more about the house on Hilltop Road, or is that storyline complete?
It is not complete.
This is from a bunch of people. What are those tape recorders? Are you ever going to tell us about them in detail?
Yes.
This is from Michael Bush. Do avatars of the lonely have other powers than just turning invisible?
I mean, they don't turn invisible. They just make it so they're not where everyone else is. And also they can send people to the lonely. And it depends on the avatar. Like, every avatar has fundamentally different powers. I think with the lonely, the being able to send them into a world with no one else is a strong commonality. But other lonely avatars might have completely different powers. Other lonely avatars might make it so that you forgot everyone you ever cared about. Or that everyone you ever cared about forgot you. That might be a power. Who knows?
Okay, on to a question from Nicole. Can we finally get an answer as to what power is at work in Mag 005 Thrown Away?
No. Actually, you know what? Yes. All right.
Oh, really? Are we going to put this to bed?
All right, I'll put this to bed.
All right, let's put this to bed.
Okay.
Then.
So, number 5, Thrown Away, was a very early version of Tom Han and the Flesh. It was the whole, like, being able to remove something, and it was playing with ideas of surplus, of overproduction, this sort of thing. Also the idea of, like, body parts that have been transformed. But a lot of the thematic elements had not been quite nailed down because it was still very early in the writing process, and so it got a bit muddied. But to be honest, also, probably a lot of other powers at work there. It's like a pretty... It's a grab bag of fears because like, so from a meta point of view, it's a muddy one because there's lots of different powers at play.
Flesh-ish.
It was written as kind of flesh-adjacent. In retrospect, it's a lot more complicated than that. A lot of it was just because it was one of the early ones, and we were still workshopping a lot of stuff.
I'm glad we managed to put that one to bed. I didn't know whether we'd go the entire thing.
Yeah, it's
never
one of those.
Address.
It's one of those ones where, like, I've never wanted to really say because the answer is, well, it's this one, but we didn't do it very well. and also because I know that a lot of people are like, no, I really like Thrown Away because it sticks out. It doesn't conform. And like, yeah, that's because. It's because we didn't write it consistently. But at the
it's
same
not the right
time.
Number of gunshots, though.
But at the same time, it's one of those ones that I've been happy to answer to people who've asked it face to face to me. So I'm like, you know what? I might as well just go on record.
Another one from basically everyone. What's up with John's lighter? Is it significant? What's going on there?
Yeah, it's significant.
From Kershaw, but I know other people as well. Are we going to hear anything about Rosie's backstory? She's a woman of mystery.
I don't know.
I categorically want to.
I
like, want and will are not the same thing.
It depends. There is a non-zero chance we'll meet her in season 5, but it depends if meeting her would make the series better. I'm not going to put her in there for the sake of having her in there.
Yeah, yeah.
There are certain things that are still up in the air in season 5, so maybe, but I'm not promising anything.
Okay, this one's from Seb. If John could tell his season 1 self something, what would it be?
Run
bail.
Away. Just,
bail.
Just stop. Just go
immediately
away.
Immediately bail.
You've made some mistakes.
It's already a bad
also,
call.
Also, leave Martin alone.
Just bail. That's basically what everyone would say to season 1.
You're making
one,
a mistake.
Just leave. Just leave.
Elias is a prick.
Just leave and the problem goes away.
I mean, like, to be fair, they've all, like, it doesn't because they've already joined the Institute.
Season
they can't
one,
quit.
Well,
but,
technically season 1 they've already joined. Yeah. Okay, yeah, fair point.
But it's from an emotional standpoint, that's still the advice. I think stay put.
Have a perpetual slowdown, you know, like a strike action.
Yeah, well, no, like what Melanie was doing.
Yeah,
in,
literally.
In
but
season
just
4.
Do that. Sustain it. Just stick with it.
Yeah.
And if nothing else, you'll buy yourself a good 15 years extra.
Yeah.
Works
for
Gertrude.
Yeah.
This one's from Not Tori. Mm-hmm. What kind of music do you like or listen to when writing?
Oh, my musical tastes change quite a lot gradually. When I'm writing, it's kind of a dull answer, but when I'm writing, I tend to listen to dark ambient playlists on Spotify.
Also rain.
Like a rain generator for some. If a statement has like a muted quality to it, I like to listen to rain sounds. Otherwise, just like generic dark ambient spooky sounds. It's not a particularly interesting answer, but it gets me in the headspace. Outside of that, currently in a post-rock phase. Really enjoying just ridiculous albums with like the most pretentious title names. Something like Shit Heap Gloria, Ode to a Town Planner or something like that.
Nice.
Like they're all just ridiculous and I love them, and it's just half of it is just elderly American men just rambling on about
literally
radio
anything.
Towers or like weird spiritualist conspiracies.
Right, I'm going to give you a choice for the last question of this round of Q&A.
Okay.
So, would you rather a question that touches on RPGs or a question that touches further upon cats? Big decision time.
You know what?
What are you feeling?
I'm going to keep the cats for the Patreon.
Okay, RPGs then. So this is from Thimbraeus.
Mm-hmm.
What classes would the Archives crew be in D&D? Hard mode, only one of them can be a warlock. I.e. with a patron.
Right, okay. Yeah, okay. Okay, let's have a think. So, Elias would be a cleric, I think, rather than a warlock. I think...
You could go mastermind with him, rogue mastermind.
Yeah.
But it, to be clear, it is cleric. Like, you are correct.
I mean, like, Tim's a fighter. Like, I'd love to say he's like a bard because of his high charisma.
You could have gone so far as paladin. Because high charisma, punchy, self-righteous.
He takes his... I think his turn is too pragmatic to be a paladin.
I would agree with that. So we've got Tim as a fighter.
I think Basira is a paladin.
Oh, yeah.
Basira is a paladin. Daisy starts out... I think Daisy starts out as a rogue, actually. She starts out as like an assassin rogue and then converts into a barbarian that refuses to use her rage powers.
Bang on. Daisy multiclassed. It didn't really gel as much as it could have.
100%.
Yeah. Okay. Melanie
is...
It's rogue. It's got to be rogue.
No. I'm sorry. You're just saying that because Lyd plays Sasha in real life.
She plays rogues in real life.
Yeah. No, I think...
I would do it as rogue investigator. I really would. Because she's got that angle
to her. I think
she's
a ranger. Because she's got her favourite enemy.
Ooh. Okay, I can actually get on board with that.
She's very driven in terms of tracking. And when she's out of her specific element, she finds it very difficult.
You know what? I take mine back. Ranger is a better choice there. Ranger is a better choice. In which case, then...
So who does that leave? So obviously,
we've still got Martin and John.
Original Sasha, wizard.
Yes.
Like, conscientious, knows her stuff.
A bit too empirical when her life's on the line.
Does the reading, and unfortunately, very easy to... kill when found alone.
Very squishy. Okay then. Martin then.
Difficult.
Commoner?
Overambitious
NPC?
I'm probably going to go with Bard because his thing is trying to support everyone else.
I think he might just be a
and
cohort.
He does.
I think he might just
he's,
be.
He's a bard.
I think he might he's, just be a cohort.
He's a bard, but unfortunately he doesn't have an instrument. He chose poetry and isn't very well min-maxed.
He's a bard who was just like, cool, guys, so what skills do we still have to cover? Proficiency in land vehicles. Yeah, okay, I'll take that.
Yeah.
We don't have urban survival. Okay, I'll take that, I guess.
Yeah. And John's the warlock, isn't he?
Yes, due to the fluff, but I still maintain he doesn't play like a warlock.
No, that's fair. What does he play like then?
He plays like a wizard.
No, he doesn't.
Yes, he does.
He doesn't because he doesn't do... like he's not meticulous. He's not meticulous in how he approaches things.
I didn't say he was a good wizard.
No.
He's a wizard that picks a fight with something far bigger than he is and releases something into the
world.
He's
a warlock who thinks he's a druid.
Expand.
He thinks, like, a lot of his stuff comes... naturally from connections that he feels are natural. And I think that he tries to engage with the world
but actually a lot of his stuff has come
from
a very
dark place. Oh no, you know
what
he is. We forgot to take into account the player behind the character. What John is a warlock played by a player who's like, I'm not going to take anything for combat. And everyone's like, come on, please take something. No, I'm going to take only social abilities. And everyone's like, I mean, okay.
Or he's a warlock who the player hasn't actually told anyone else is a warlock and is pretending that they're a druid.
Right, we're going to have to call it there. If yours hasn't been answered on here, there's always a chance that we'll be answering it on the extra Patreon episode. Obviously, it is worth mentioning that we are on our season hiatus currently.
Yep.
We are going to be releasing hiatus content about once every 2 weeks or so, where there's going to be extra things to sort of keep things moving and let people see a bit more into how we make things, stuff like that. And in the meantime, obviously, do check us out on social media. Do check out Twitter. I mean, if you're already listening, a lot of people do.
Yep.
But apart from that, it's just say thanks. You've made it to the end of the world.
Thanks, everyone.
So good job on that one.
Hope you enjoyed the ride.
That isn't over. No, it's not over. There is
it's
a full season.
Yeah, absolutely.
But apart from that, I guess that's everything. So thanks, everyone, and we'll be checking with you real soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike 4.0 international license. For more information, visit rustyquill.com. Tweet us at @TheRustyQuill, visit us on Facebook, or email us at mail@rustyquill.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi everyone, it's Kareem, the voice of Simon Fairchild from the Magnus Archives. Today, I'm here to advertise Beck's End, an upcoming new audio drama that will be launching on the RQ Network. Beck's End is a folk horror audio drama about isolation, belief, radicalization, and poses the question if redemption is possible. When floodwaters swallow an idyllic English Lake District village, a stranded journalist finds herself trapped in a rising tide of fear. Cut off from the outside world, she begins to uncover horrors both human and biblical, lurking beneath the surface. If this intrigues you, you can support the creation of Beck's End on Kickstarter until the 17th of July. For more information on the show and to pledge your support, visit becksend.com. That's becksend.com. And you might recognize a voice here or there. Have fun and enjoy the episode.
Hi, Alex here, founder and CEO of Rusty Quill Limited. In case you haven't heard, there is now a Magnus Archives novel. The Library of Jürgen Leitner is set in the world of the Magnus Archives and written by Nebula Award-winning author Premi Mohammed with our very own Jonathan Sims. The story follows Hugh, a university dropout, desperate to find somewhere to belong and his new job at an esoteric library. The books he must investigate for the enigmatic Jürgen Leitner are not normal, because the library is not a vault, sealed and silent, but a hive, alive, buzzing, and ready to sting. The Library of Jürgen Leitner releases October 27th, 2026, but you can pre-order it right now in the US and UK from your local bookshop or by using the link in the episode description. If you live outside of the UK or US, you may be able to make an international order for this first publication, but it depends on individual retailers' shipping policies.